Well, hello, I'm Max Brantley with the Arkansas Times, and I'm here with Benjamin Hardy, and we're going to talk about things that happened in Arkansas last week. Lindsey Miller's off gallivanting somewhere, and so we're going to try and fill in, and I'm going to play his role as host. And I'm going to throw it first to Benji on medical marijuana. The commission met this week. Are we going to ever have medical marijuana in Arkansas?
Well, theoretically, one day. The commission at least says they're hoping to hasten that day a bit by giving the process of grading the dispensary applications that they've received, some 200 plus applications, out of which they'll choose 32 lucky winners, rather than doing that themselves as they did with the cultivation applications in the previous round of grading. They'll be giving it to an independent outside third party to actually do the grading process. And in doing that, they say they hope to expedite that process a little bit, but probably more significantly, reduce their own legal exposure, since the scoring process for the cultivators, which concluded in February, was the result of massive litigation and a lot of questions and concerns about conflicts of interests and irregularities in the scoring and so on.
And it looked like politics reared its head again in deciding on using an outside helpmate.
Right. Yeah, that was interesting. So there's five commissioners. The two that have come under the most scrutiny probably are Dr. Carlos Roman and Roman, I believe.
I'm not sure.
And Travis Story, who's an attorney from Northwest Arkansas. Both of them have been accused by some of the losing applicants of having conflicts of interest in their personal lives with two of the winning applicants.
Well, and I think it is absolutely factual to say that each of them had some business or personal relationships with people who were involved in cultivation applications.
Sure.
And that in the case of the doctor, had a fairly unusual, and to Story also had some, seemed to be some scoring anomalies, which I think they both protested were honest anomalies, but nonetheless they offered some at least circumstantial evidence that gave people pause.
Right. Yeah.
Then again, they want to retain control of the voting.
The names were redacted off of those cultivation applications, but I mean, you can tell. I mean, where they're coming from in some cases. And right. I mean, I think Dr. Roman in particular put up, this huge amount of protest about saying that he had, he found it so offensive, the idea that anything in his scoring process was untoward or improper. And as I noted on the Arkansas blog, one way to interpret their protestations about this using the dispensary scoring, using a third party for the dispensary scoring is, well, just a matter of reputation.
They don't want to give any indication.
They don't want to give an inch.
There might have been something wrong with
right.
The first scoring.
So, their position is like, oh, what do you mean? The scoring that we did with the cultivators was as good as it could possibly get.
Well, we're not quite through, really, the cultivation fight. Well, I think the commission thinks it is. But do you think we are?
Well, I don't know.
They had a fight this week over the sixth place finisher.
Correct, which is important. Five slots to be filled with the cultivators. But number six is especially important because if any of the top five were to be disqualified, then the sixth place runner-up would be the next
in line. Actually, by law, they could do eight.
They could expand. Correct. Right. And also by choosing to keep all of those cultivation applications active rather than outright notifying them that they've failed, those next in line applications, should they choose to award other slots, are especially important.
Was there any kind of progress report this week on whether anybody's put any seeds in the ground since the award of the cultivation permit?
That didn't come up that I heard. If it was mentioned, I missed it. That I think the from the cultivator's end, they'd be unwise, I think, to start cultivating now if there's no certainty about the retail side.
Yeah, I don't know. Does marijuana store well?
I
wouldn't know.
Just put it in the freezer, I hear.
I suppose so. I forget where I was going on the cultivation end of things, but it's well, I, Oh, I know. The question I wanted to ask you was, is do they have any idea how long it's going to take to do the dispensary reviews, application reviews?
Well, so they had somebody there from the Office of State Procurement who talked about this process for getting an independent consultant.
Right, that'll take some time.
It will, though they're not doing a typical request for proposals because, you know, that might require like some actual vetting of who all these different possible companies. And so instead they're doing this sort of expedited procurement process by which they'll they can work with the company that's already been vetted for a different state contract. And in doing so, they'll just take the lowest bidder. And they have some sort of scope of work about what they expect to see from that company. But they say that by November, they could get this turned around and have a list of these winners, I suppose, based on
at least it would be the outsider's recommendation. The commission would still retain the right to review that in some fashion.
Right. They had an interesting little discussion about that, too. And I would say, I mean, that is a point to the question of like, are you going to about, I guess, well, in the words of Travis Story, passing the buck or giving somebody else the job of doing this. Like, once this outside party makes their recommendation, then if the commission is in the position of then deciding they don't like something about that recommendation and saying, well, we don't really think this is correct, then what do you do then? You know, it's sort of like they've got to give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down.
Because then it would become either a full review, which would be enormously time consuming,
right,
or some really arbitrary thing of individual commissioners saying, well, I like the quick stop in Marianna, and the other one says, no, I want the Happy Hollow in Fayetteville.
Right. And then it's just crying out for another lawsuit.
And arbitrary decisions and lawsuits and right. No, they may be married to the recommendations pretty strongly.
So it would seem, yeah. So, I mean, you know, but, I mean, assuming that they get a company who's going to do this professionally and quickly and reasonably fairly, then
So maybe by the end of the year we'll have successful dispensary applications.
It's possible.
And then at that point cultivators can grow. And what they say, it's about a 2-month process if you have the facility,
right,
to produce a crop.
Right.
And so, get it around. So maybe marijuana by Easter? I don't know. That's kind of sacrilegious to say, I suppose. Well, let's move on. What about the Buffalo River? What about another regulatory agency, the Department of Environmental Quality, which has had the job of reviewing pollution in waterways, which is figured in the hog farm. But more than that, you've been on the Buffalo River lately. There's an issue that, and I don't want to link this to the hog farm because I think almost certainly it's bigger than the hog farm and may not be related to the hog farm at all. Hmm. And that's this huge algae problem.
Well, yeah, and you know, as with so many environmental things, there's just you got to be careful about how much you draw cause and effect, I'd say.
Right.
Right. So,
well, there's no doubt there's a lot of algae.
There is certainly a lot of algae up there, right? And rivers, grow algae in Arkansas
in the
summertime.
And it's a terrible summer,
and it's been dry, and those conditions contribute. But certainly. You know, it's hard not to at least ask that question about, like, well, you have this big farm upriver upstream that's putting a lot of nutrients into the ground, and how does
that affect
water?
And of course, there are other chicken farmers and cattle farmers in the watershed that are putting stuff in there too.
But that's true. Yeah,
but the Department of Environmental Quality has found some kind of bacteria that has some potential to be dangerous.
Yeah. So I mean, not all algae growth is harmful to people, but there are some types of blooms that produce toxins that are harmful to people and can make kids and adults and pets sick. And they've issued the National Park Service issued a warning, sort of vaguely worded.
Yeah, they didn't quite call it a warning. They're not posting signs.
Right, and they made it clear that, well, they didn't make it exactly clear. We're trying to get some clarity on that right now, but they said there's been some early testing done, and it indicates the presence of cyanobacteria, I believe, or
yeah, some big long word that I don't understand.
But there's some cause for concern that the organisms that produce these toxins are present, but they said in levels low enough that you know, it's beneath a threshold. So, but at the same time,
but they were prompted to say, "Don't swallow the water."
They're saying,
if you can avoid,
at least out of caution, if you see algae, don't swim in the river in that spot. And
I don't like to swim in algae. Just by the way,
no.
Sometimes on the Buffalo, if you're canoeing, you know, you end in the water unexpectedly.
Yeah, well, you know, so me and some friends went floating there last weekend, and we did a fair amount of swimming, I gotta say.
You found stretches that were clear?
There were, but I mean, it's relatively speaking, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's gross, so you don't really want to swim in algae-infested water.
Well, I grew up in South Louisiana, and sometimes you'd have eras when the swimming pools would develop this algae bloom that you couldn't knock out no matter how much chlorine you put in it, and swimming in it was just, I mean, it was safe, but it was just kind of yucky.
So, appetizing.
Yeah, it was not very delightful. Well,
well, and then there's this other issue with the buffalo, right?
I mean, we had another thing today, and this is directly hog farm related, and that is there's an ongoing fight over whether the C&H hog farm, which is a concentrated animal feeding operation, factory hog farm, if you will, at Mount Judy, that is caught up in whether it does or doesn't have a permit and whether it can get a different kind of permit, and the ins and outs of that are too complicated really to go into, but they're at a process where they're trying to get a declaration from first an administrative law judge and then the Pollution Control and Ecology Commission that they have a permit to operate for all time. And the Arkansas Farm Bureau has entered this fight. They're now paying the lawyers for C&H Hog Farm. You've got to understand that while some of us worry about the Buffalo River, and C&H Hog Farm is on a tributary of the Buffalo, and they say they haven't polluted the river in any way, and they're doing a good operation. And so far to date, I don't think findings of direct harm are out there. I mean, there's some competing science.
Right. The science is not conclusive yet, I think, is the
right. And there's a question of whether when things are found, if it's a result of migration in the water table or not, that sort of thing. But in any event, this fight is going on, and the Farm Bureau sees if you can shut down one farm in the Buffalo, well, then you might be able to shut down a farm on the Ouachita River or something. And so this is much bigger than the Buffalo to the Farm Bureau.
Uh-huh.
Well, and this is where politics enter in. About a month ago, I think, maybe a little longer, Governor Asa Hutchinson put Mike Freeze on the State Pollution Control and Ecology Commission. He's a leader in the Arkansas Farm Bureau. He's a fish farmer himself at Keough. And so he had a meeting today at which the hearing on these permits for the hog farm came up. And Mike Freeze, before he joined the commission, had written numerous emails and statements in support of saying, quit it, forget it, this is over with, C&H ought to have a permit. And so in today's meeting, people representing environmental groups said that he should recuse, that he should not vote on the decisions on permits affecting C&H Hog Farm because he entered it with a clear appearance of conflict of interest.
Based on these statements.
Based on his statements when he was a private citizen. I mean, and he said, nope, I'm not getting off, I'm voting, and I'm able to put all that aside and be a neutral fact finder. And then he voted for the hog farm. I think he may have been the only one that voted today for the hog farm. So that was kind of a discouraging start for his time. And I mean, I think Ace is clearly looking at that seat as being somebody that represents agricultural interests. And he's a fisheries biologist himself. He has a background where I don't doubt he has some respect for the environment and for healthy animal life. But I think the record is, in total, that the Farm Bureau is among those that would like less regulation rather than more. Let's put it in the nicest way possible. And there's environmental people that would like more clean air and water rules than less. And right now, those who favor less hold more power than those who favor more. I think if that makes any sense at all, I'm not sure that it's sure that it does. Well, you know, Asa Hutchinson brings me to mind a variety of events that have occurred in recent weeks. One was a week or so ago, the release of the state schools' performance on the new, well, it's not new, I guess it's, was its second year of the ACT Aspire test for grading how well students are meeting education objectives. Mm. And the Education Department put out a really artful news release that more or less said, well, we're about holding our ground. Well, in fact, they're losing ground in most categories. Mm-hmm. And next year, the national scores on another test are going to, the cut score, the passing score is going up. And so there's some concern that where we didn't look so good this year, we might look worse next year. Okay. Although I think we're adjusting our things to make it not look so bad, but there was that for the education governor. And then yesterday at the Higher Education Commission, there was a report on the rate at which students are going to college after graduating from high school.
Which is something that in Arkansas, I mean, Arkansas has always especially lagged behind.
We've always been behind.
Even with progress, I mean, relatively speaking, over the past couple decades with some K-12 scores, the college-going rate has been at the bottom of the barrel.
And the figures, as released yesterday, show basically a steady five-year erosion in that rate. And this is for a governor who's been claiming great success in education. So this follows on the standardized test scores. And I this morning wrote something that was kind of hard and I think justifiably on the Higher Education Commission experts for saying that, well, they don't have all the data. That figure, our college-going rate doesn't include private schools and homeschoolers. And her presumption seemed to be that, well, if they do much better, and if you added those in, our college-going rate wouldn't be 20 points behind the national average. Well, I did some simple arithmetic. There are only 1,300 graduates of homeschool last year, 1,500 to 2,000 maybe of private schools. The Education Department has surveyed private schools in the past, and as recently as 2016 said Arkansas's rate was of college going among private school students was only 68%. It wasn't 100%. But I said, let's say every single private school and homeschool student went to college and you added that to the numbers, we'd still be 16 points behind the national average. So, let's get real. Let's not play games. Our college going rate sucks. And there's a reason our college going rate sucks. It's a poor state. We've always been poor.
Sure.
Poor people have a hard time going to college.
People that come from households without parents with college degrees have a harder time.
They're disadvantaged educationally from grade one on up, and it's not any surprise that we're where we stand. And fixing that is going to be a hard job, particularly when costs are going up. They're going up because the state is not providing significant more sums to state colleges to operate, and tuition goes up instead because the colleges aren't getting state money. That makes it even harder for poor students to go. And then the one new money that came in to help people go to college, the Arkansas Scholarship Lottery, has been jiggered in a way to favor upper-middle-class white kids. Because they've made the requirement to get the scholarship a higher ACT score, which essentially ends up discriminating against poor kids. I mean, that's just what it does.
The more merit-based it is, the more likely it is that it's going to benefit people who come from
better off families.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's just a sad thing. That's all. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the argument that you might just need to invest more money into kids who start off from sort of behind the eight ball.
No, it seems strange to me that we're shifting our emphasis to the haves from the have-nots.
Yeah. Right?
When clearly the market that needs more college is not at the high end. I mean, the college-going rate is not low among the well-off.
Right. Well, you know, this goes back to that same sort of assumption about education, that it's the problem is not that it requires an investment of money. The problem is just, like, I guess, removing some... I don't know.
Yeah, and it's kind of a more...
Let the market do its work.
Well, it's also a holistic application of money. I mean, that is, in healthcare, for example, healthy kids do better in school than sick kids do. And we've now set out on a program to make the poor be sure they work to get Medicaid, for example. Now, we've got kids covered. But what the studies show, and I saw an interesting study this week, is that... There have been study after study of various work requirements on various welfare programs, from food stamps to others. And what they find time and time again is, number one, the work rules don't in time produce higher employment among that class. They're all these bars that there's just an infinitesimal difference. But worse than that, when you take the help away, it makes it even harder to get out of poverty, because the welfare help, combined with whatever income they're able to make, is allowing them to get by. And then you take that away, and then they're just screwed.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, I've got sad news galore.
What else you got?
Well, we've got the highways. A judge refused to stop the Interstate 630 widening project. And my guess would be that means that lawsuit goes away. I mean, with the building underway, I think continuing to fight it for failure to have an environmental study is probably a loser. But it did raise the issue that that project is absolutely tied into the 30 Crossing project, the big downtown freeway expansion. And the comment period on the environmental study of that highway just completed this week. And I gather that there will be complaints from many that it wasn't an adequate environmental assessment, including for failure to consider no plans to do anything about the link up with 630 for all this new traffic.
And so that's well, something I actually don't understand is, are these things completely considered independent of each other?
I mean, they are not. The highway department acknowledges the 30 Crossing thing will have impact on connector highways, but it's only looking at the impact on that, however, 6 mile stretch of road between the two south and north terminal interchanges.
I see.
And at this point, in fact, the 630 widening, which now will be widened from I-430 University Avenue, there's nothing anticipated between University Avenue and I-630. And what somebody at Metroplan has said is that if 630 isn't widened and it's not kind of done in concert with the 30 Crossing project, 630 traffic is going to back up into I-30, and it's just going to be a mess. Of course, this isn't a surprise. I mean, California is a textbook. You don't build your way out of congestion. Freeways beget more congestion.
Uh-huh.
We ought to be looking at different ways to do things, particularly as the whole world changes in cars and every other way. But that's we do things the way we do. And the other thing about the I-30 work, that there's been some significant changes that Leslie Peacock wrote about in the Times in the last version of the plan. And the changes of downtown exit means there are going to be some dramatic changes on the downtown grid system. And the state does nothing about that. The 30 Crossing Project does nothing for city streets. That's going to be the responsibility of the city. And the city isn't exactly broken out with money. So. And speaking of lack of money, you wrote this week about the consultant's report on whether University of Arkansas Little Rock should start a football program.
Well, yes, I wrote a little bit about it. I did not exactly dig into the 179 pages of the report, but this has been a long time coming. I think they commissioned it something like 9 months ago, and I think, you know, to a lot of initial fanfare, it was billed as this could be this great boost for the city, the city of Little Rock, and I think Department of Parks and Tourism were partners in commissioning the study.
They want a tenant for the football stadium,
right?
For War Memorial Stadium,
right? Right. I mean, in the abstract, I can see you can see the appeal of that, but then when you start looking at the numbers about what it would require, it's just a doubling of the budget for.
The current budget is $11 million, and they said if you took it to a level that was like at ASU's level, the top tier, it'd be around $24 million, but ASU spends more than that. I think they just took an average figure for colleges that size, and there'd be something like a $40 million investment required in new facilities. I mean, not the stadium, but just other stuff. You know, you got to have workout facilities and indoor training facilities and all this crud.
Right.
And also, if you add football to meet Title IX standards of treating men and women equally, you'd have to add some women's sports, and that would cost money too. And I don't think UA Little Rock's in a place to add that amount of money. And the other significant part of the report, I thought, was they didn't seem to detect great enthusiasm among UA Little Rock philanthropists to contribute to football.
To say the least, there's a pretty strong enthusiasm among students.
Students seem to want football.
Sure. And for understandable reasons, you know.
Although they have one of the highest per hour student fees in the state already, and I mean ASU pays for its football with student fees and auxiliary fees, and UA Little Rock would have to be the same.
Right.
I mean, do they really want to increase their you know, $200 or $300 a semester to have a football team?
I wonder how the question was worded, and I wonder if that would be an interesting question to ask those same
students. Yeah, I wonder if the question said, would you still want football if you knew that a 15-hour student would be looking at a $200 a semester increase in their tuition?
Right. Though, as you point out, you know, even even if you did jack up the fees, you're still going to have significant local philanthropic support. And yeah, I mean, a majority, an outright majority of the donors that they polled said that they felt negatively about the idea, which tells you something. You
know, I don't think it's going to happen, but I've been wrong many times before. Maybe UA Fayetteville could loan them some money. This week, Chad Morris bought a $3.8 million house in Fayetteville. He has 10 bedrooms.
See, that's like a third of the way there.
10 bedrooms and 12 bathrooms. He's the Razorback football coach, by the way, just in case you didn't know. If Chad Morris is not yet a household name. So they're doing okay up there. Anyway, we're going to have some famous guests in town, or at least in Hot Springs, Lake Hamilton, next week. Betsy DeVos and Jeff Sessions are heading down to Lake Hamilton School District and pronounce good the fact that that school has had people carrying concealed weapons, staff members as trained security officers for, I guess, 25 years now, the assistant superintendent told me.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that, and I remember, I mean, this was years and years ago. I think it was after, you know, the terrible events at Sandy Hook that the legislature held some hearings about school safety, like 2014, 2013. And I remember going to some of those hearings when I was still working at the Legislative Digest about And one of the things that stands out to me is, like, so, I mean, there were two school districts that really grabbed attention. One was Lake Hamilton, which had had this longtime policy of, I think they have, like, maybe a safe on campus or something with, like, a couple of administrators have access to a gun. Right. And then, as you said, there's some armed security, which is not the most unusual thing to have, like, you know, some school resource officers and so forth. And then the other district was Clarksville, which had a much more radical sort of approach.
They really moved into it big time.
They were like, they were talking about, you know, arming classroom teachers and staff and something like 20 people on this fairly small campus who were potentially licensed to carry concealed weapons is around with them on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think it might be that Hamilton is kind of more of a hybrid, whereas Clarksville kind of, I don't want to use the word bloodthirsty for their superintendent, but gun friendly, certainly. I kind of, you get the feeling there that there'd just almost be no limit on how many it'd be good to have on staff carrying weapons. The Lake Hamilton assistant superintendent did tell me that they've got two trained security guards. One of them is a former law enforcement officer who carry weapons. And then next year they're going to have a Garland County deputy sheriff, a real school resource officer. And then they won't reveal the number, but X number of staff members who've been through the security guard training who can carry weapons. But he did say none of them are teachers. And I think, I'm pretty sure at Clarksville there's some teachers.
Oh, at least a few years ago when this was under discussion, that was a big part.
And so there is that difference. To this point, Governor Hutchinson at least has said that he doesn't really think, he thinks teachers have enough to do. And he's at least been willing to say that they don't have that. And so maybe Lake Hamilton presents sort of a slightly more moderate approach to the arming issue.
Yeah,
Mike Poore, by the way, this week answered a question on Twitter from A Mom's Demand, one of the group that's working for common sense gun laws, and he said absolutely opposes any teachers having any guns.
Right, and I think, I mean, he said something along those lines, a little bit less forcefully.
Wasn't the first time.
Yeah,
he said
but
that.
When it came up before at one of the community board meetings, and the proposal I think he's put out there is arming some of the non-law enforcement officer security staff that they have in the district.
Right, and they are talking about doing that and maybe increasing the number of resource officers. I mean, they are in a position, at least until all their money is taken by charter schools, that they can afford more than a small school district can. And in some fairness to those districts, if you've come to the belief that you have to have guns on campus, I mean, hiring a real officer is expensive.
It is, right.
You know, I asked the Lake Hamilton guy, and he and I both said it was kind of bad luck if you believe in suspicion. I mean, jinxes to even ask about it. But no, they've never had a gun discharged on their campus.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
This is this old thing about, you know, you don't want to say, oh, you're worrying too much about security. This minute you do something terrible will happen.
Right.
And people say, see, but this balancing act between what you do about security and what's required against the potential risk, it does seem to me we overreact to me.
Well, yeah, I mean,
when I was a kid, anybody could walk in the front door of my school. You can't do that anymore. That's probably a good thing. It's probably a good thing that the front door is locked after the kids are in, and that you have to have somebody admit you during the day. Alarm systems. I mean, there are a lot of things you can do short of putting a bunch of people with pistols in your hallways.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I feel a little bit torn about it just because on principle, you know, I think my heart's in the same place as everybody who says we just don't need more guns on campus. More guns in schools cannot be the right answer.
Well, I think this...
On the other hand, I don't know. I can't
see... Well, yeah,
see,
you don't want to say, oh, God, if... I mean, I think to me that the fault is in the presumption that having an armed person on campus has suddenly made your campus safer. Number one, there's a lot of ground to cover.
Right.
Number two, kids are smart. I mean, the kid that shot up the Florida high school knew there were armed officers around and knew where they were.
Right.
Secondly, I think the statistics such as they exist, although the gun lobby has tried to prevent their compilation by reliable sources, is that if you have more guns in a place, the potential for bad, it's kind of like throwing a football in football. You know, you can, two out of three things that happen are bad. You know, you can drop the pass or have it intercepted or complete the pass.
Right.
With a gun, you could stop the very rare instance of an armed attack in the very rare times they happen. Or you could accidentally shoot the gun, or somebody could steal the gun.
Same principle as having a gun in your home readily accessible.
I mean, right? more bad things happen with guns when you have more guns around. I mean, and that's not because of people missing. I mean, just bad, you know, they get stolen, you drop them. I mean,
right.
And I read a purported study the other day that said when trained law enforcement officers use guns, they hit their targets only about 20% of the time. And so... You know, that means four shots out of five don't hit, and what do they hit?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a school full of kids, you know, maybe somebody. I mean, I know there was a hostage situation at a Trader Joe's in Los Angeles last week, and one person was killed, and they were killed by police gunfire, not by the guy who was holding the hostage.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's anecdotal and not proof of anything, but except an example of what can happen.
Right.
Well, do you have any good news? Anything?
Well, I will say the Buffalo River was beautiful.
Well, good, that's good.
Algae or no algae, it was really one of the...
It's an Arkansas treasure, and I think that's why some people get so worked up about any potential harm, even when it's not yet demonstrated yet.
Right, yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it'd been years since I'd been there, at least on the canoeing. I've hiked up there almost every year, but on the water, it's just such a great... I realize, like, in the summertime in Arkansas, you know, there's just I love to camp. I love to hike and get outside. Yeah. And you just – there's a block of time in the summer in Arkansas where that's just kind of a non-starter.
You know, walking is – yeah, no, but being on water.
You go on a boat and it's just
– Yeah, it makes it's so all good. It's all the difference in the world. I want to mention one little piece of news that nobody else reported that I reported this week, and it's a long – way out there story, but the Attorney General approved a proposed constitutional amendment that would change the way we draw legislative boundaries every 10 years. We currently have a three-member board, the governor, attorney general, and secretary of state, who draw state legislative boundaries, and the legislature does the congressional boundaries. This is a proposal that would set up a quasi-independent commission. There'd be two members appointed by Democrats, two by Republicans, and then that group would take three from other applicants, and they couldn't have political contacts of any sort. They'd be about as close to nonpartisan as you could get.
Hmm.
And several other states have done this, and it reduces gerrymandering. It seems like a great idea to me. The interesting thing is this particular proposal was proposed by Skip Cook, who's a term limits guy, and it's almost word for word a copy of a proposal David Couch, working for a progressive group, had tried to get approved last year but kept running into roadblocks with Leslie Rutledge. And so he's, and David Kaus tells me his group is still interested in trying the same amendment too. So there might be competing petition proposals for similar independent redistricting commissions. This would be to get on the ballot in 2020, but that would be in time for the next round of redistricting in the 2021 legislature. So this isn't much worth talking about a lot, but just to get it on your screen.
So this is a state legislative boundaries or the federal?
Well, it's both. It's both. It would be a state. The state constitution determines how both state and federal districts are drawn.
Okay.
The state boundaries are drawn by a three-member commission, which now happens to be all Republican.
Uh-huh.
And the legislature, which is, of course, majority Republican, would draw the congressional district lines.
Okay.
This would just make this commission do both.
Okay.
So anyway, but it's good government, I think, and other states have done it, and it's really made the process fair. I mean, I know somebody would say, oh, you want to do it now because Republicans are in control. Well, when the Democrats were in control in 2010 or 2011, it didn't work out very well for them. So,
that's
so,
true.
I mean, it's not necessarily a given that partisan control produces the outcomes you want. And so I think a sensible system makes sense. So I recommend that. That's
your recommendation.
That's my recommendation for the week. Let's change the way we draw legislative boundaries. Not too sexy, but it's a good idea. You got anything to
Sounds
recommend?
Good. Ooh, well, I mean, I guess I'll recommend our best of issue this week.
You know, it was
good. I got the chance to interview local photographer Tim Hersley.
Who's a fascinating artist.
Yeah, he's a really interesting guy. And I mean, I don't know much about photography or visual art in general, so it was a real departure for me. But it was a lot of fun to look through his sort of multi-decade body of work. Yes, he's just super sleek, hyper-modernist buildings that he's sort of known for. I mean, that's what he's commissioned to do. That's sort of
right.
His day job. And then like MoMA in New York, and then on the other hand, he does all of these just sort of weirdo, offhand, very intimate, personal things like photographing funeral homes in Pine Bluff or Helena. He has some work on display at the Delta exhibition. I think that's up until sometime in August, which I have yet to stop by and see the full thing, but I plan to. So that's my recommendation.
Sounds good. Oh, I might add that I did contribute a short squib. Go out to Mike's place on Asher Avenue and have the banh mi, the Vietnamese sandwich. It's on a French bread with some crunchy vegetables and a little bit of meat. It costs
$3. Great stuff.
A $3 lunch. You cannot beat that with a stick in Little Rock. Well, I guess we're done. I'm Max Brandy with Benji Hardy, and we're going to call it quits.
All right.
See you next week.